Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. The drinking water crisis in Flint, Michigan, which exposed tens of thousands of people to toxic lead levels, has raised many questions about the quality of our tap water. In recent years, a number of reports by water rights and environmental groups have identified many issues with our drinking water systems, including the lack of spending on water infrastructures, weak regulation and enforcement policies, the privatization of public water, and the impact of lead, especially on children. Earlier this year, in the first nationwide assessment of drinking water quality over several decades, researchers from UC Irvine found that between 1982 and 2015, every year, up to 45 million people were affected by water quality issues, especially those living in low-income and rural communities. In 2015, as many as 21 million Americans may have been exposed to unsafe drinking water. So what will it take to ensure that tap water in the U.S. is safe to drink, and what practical measures can be taken to get there? Today, we're joined by Mara Allaire, Assistant Professor of Urban Policy and Public Planning at UC Irvine. Mara Allaire is the lead author of the in-depth report, National Trends in Drinking Water Quality Violations, which was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And Mara joins us on the phone from Irvine. Hi, Mara. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. We're also joined by Mary Grant, Public Water for All campaign director at Food and Water Watch, a national nonprofit that champions healthy food and clean water for all. Mary Grant oversees campaigns to support universal access to safe water in the U.S. by promoting affordable public provisions of water and sewer services. And Mary joins us on the phone from Washington, D.C. Hi, Mary. Welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Mara, you lived about a half hour away from Flint when the water crisis happened, and people around the world were shocked that something like this would affect an American city. People in Flint still say they don't trust their water, their drinking water. The state of Michigan is spending $22,000 a day on bottled water. 12,000 kids were exposed to excessive lead, most of them from Flint's poorest families. It's kind of shocking to think that it's been about 3 years since this happened. But what would you say has changed since then, specifically in Flint?
Sure. Well, I would say one of the bigger things that's changed, especially at the national level, is really taking a close look at the regulations that were supposed to be safeguarding people's tap water, and in particular, the lead and copper rule, which is currently undergoing revision. And so really looking to tighten up standards for that, especially in terms of how do we catch those issues in the first place, especially sort of how you go about sampling this accurately so that you can catch problems as they unfold. And I would also say there's also a national effort to roll out improved reporting. This has been in the works for years, even before the Flint crisis broke. And this involves actually cloud-based reporting between state-level agencies and the EPA, and this could allow for more accurate and consistent records for water quality concerns. So these are two major improvements that are being rolled out after the Flint crisis.
Did you expect to see a problem like this hit an American city?
Absolutely not. And what made Flint so shocking was the scale. It was, you know, a relatively large city that this did affect, a relatively large population of over 90,000 people. When I did my national study, what we were finding was, by and large, water quality issues are much more prevalent in smaller communities, and especially smaller, rural, low-income communities. So what made Flint so shocking was it was a relatively large community that was being affected.
Mary, you work on a wide range of issues affecting water. What about you? What was your reaction when you heard about this crisis in Flint?
It's actually interesting. Food and Water Watch first learned about the crisis in Flint when a member of ours reached out about the price of water in Flint. So we first came into it looking at Flint's water prices, because the emergency manager had increased water rates substantially in order to transfer revenue to the city's general fund to pay down bond investors. Mm. So that's how we first learned about it. And then when we got involved, we heard complaints about the quality of water, mostly aesthetic effects of the water, that it was discolored and contaminated. And then it was after we started working with What Are You Fighting For There, Melissa's Maze group, that it came out that there was actually lead contamination in the water. So we were really shocked about this. We had been working in Detroit around the water shutoff issue there. So we came into it from a different perspective, and we were really astounded to see the dramatic impact it's had on people's lives. They still, to this day, do not trust their tap water.
It's really amazing. What do you think, Mary, has really changed since this crisis hit Flint?
Well, I know that for folks in Flint, when I've last spoke with someone from there, they don't think things have changed at all. Mm. They still don't trust their water. They're not drinking their tap water. They said that lead levels have improved substantially on the water, but people still don't trust it. They think their pipes have been corroded within their homes. And now, right now, Flint's experiencing water shutoffs, people refusing to pay their water bills because they consider it toxic. And then now the city is going off and shutting off water that they rely on for flushing their toilets and washing their hands. I think Flint is still in a crisis. It's now the poorest city in the country. And I don't think it's any surprise that the water crisis happened in Flint, the poorest city in the country. A community of color.
And it's shocking that people are still drinking bottled water there. The state is spending about $22,000 a day on bottled water in Flint.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I know that Flint residents are now concerned because there's studies coming out about plastics and bottled water.
What are you hearing from people in Flint? I mean, and just in terms of pressuring the government to deal with this issue. Mara, how do you think the government should deal with this issue in Flint? And why is it taking so long?
Sure. Well, I think it's complicated by the fact that this wasn't acknowledged to be a concern until it was 2 years into the crisis. So I think this is complicated by the fact that there were errors made at sort of various levels, not only at the municipality level, but also at the Department of Environmental Quality in the state of Michigan. So I think the slow response is borne out by the fact that this wasn't deemed to be a violation until it had already been unfolding for two solid years that folks were coping with impaired drinking water.
Mary, what would you add?
I think we really need a renewed federal investment in our water infrastructure, not just in Flint, but across the country, with money targeted at disadvantaged communities that are struggling with compliance.
Well, and your report shows that the government has invested less and less in keeping the infrastructure up to date.
Yeah, it's fallen dramatically since the late 1970s. On a per capita basis, it's an 82% drop since 1977,
wow.
Federal funding for our water infrastructure.
An 82% drop. And this is under both Republicans and Democrats.
Yes, we saw a boost under Obama with the stimulus package, but since then it's been on the decline again. There was a slight boost this year, though, with the compromise spending bill. They increased funding for our water systems by $600 million.
Wow. Mary, you briefly talked about the amount that people in Flint are paying for their water. And this got a lot of attention last year about how people were facing $10,000 water bills, how overdue bills for unsafe water could lead to foreclosures in Flint, Michigan. What are we seeing today?
It's still an ongoing problem. I think that the county did stop the foreclosure, so tax sales of homes over unpaid water bills. But right now, so they've switched over to water shutoffs. We did a survey in 2015 looking at the 500 largest community water systems, and at the time, when Flint had toxic water, they had the highest rates in the country for water that was unsafe to drink.
Mary Grant is Public Water for All campaign director at Food and Water Watch, and Mara Allaire is assistant professor of urban policy and public planning at UC Irvine. On today's Your Calls One Planet series, we are talking about the current state of our drinking water. Mara, you lived right outside of Flint when this crisis happened, and that prompted you to take on a massive study looking at the water quality of our drinking water. Can you talk about what you wanted to accomplish and how did you go about doing it?
Sure. I think, like most folks, I was absolutely shocked that Flint occurred, and I became very concerned what the state of drinking water quality was across the country, and in particular, what types of communities might especially struggle to meet health-based drinking water quality standards. So after crunching the numbers, I did learn that violations do extend well beyond Flint. In 2015, when news about Flint did break, about 21 million people received water from systems that had violations of health-based standards. And I do want to caution listeners that the U.S. does have some of the best drinking water quality in the world, but what this study really aimed to do is identify which types of water systems and which types of communities are struggling and how can we go about informing policies that could bring everyone up to meet those national standards. And communities, it turns out, that are especially struggling are rural low-income systems. So communities that look quite a bit different than Flint, but perhaps are flying a bit under the radar because this is happening across the country, especially in lower income, more rural, less populated areas on a year-to-year basis. And what's especially worrying is that there's parts of the country, such as Oklahoma and Texas, where not only do you have one-off events, but you have water quality concerns that repeat year after year in the same community. And these types of events are especially concerning if there's a systematic violation of national level standards.
Your study shows that since 1982, between 3 and 10% of the country's water systems are in violation of the health standards outlined in the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. Can you elaborate on that? What does that mean exactly?
Sure. So in any given year, on average, between 6 to 7% in an average year of water systems won't meet standards that are geared towards protecting public health. So that doesn't mean that everyone served by that water system necessarily receives that impaired water, but water leaving the facility is not meeting either standards that are called maximum contaminant levels. So there are there's a maximum level of contamination that's allowable under national regulations, and if the water utility exceeds that, let's say they exceed the level of either lead or copper or nitrates or any of the 90-plus contaminants that are regulated by the national EPA, and that would be considered a violation. It would also be considered a violation if the water utility wasn't following through with sort of standardized treatment procedures. And so this would also be deemed a health-based violation. And these were the two that I was really focused in on in my study.
And can you talk about how the New York Times published your study along with a map? How here are the places that struggle to meet the rules on safe drinking water. How can people find out if they live in an area that is affected?
Sure, that's a great question. All these data on violations are publicly available through the EPA. And so the EPA has the Safe Drinking Water Act, and on the Safe Drinking Water Act's webpage, you can search for your city and state, and it'll pull up the full past 30 years of any type of violations that have occurred in your community. And so that's a terrific resource to have, as well as your water utility has to notify you on a yearly basis. If you live in a community over 10,000 people, they have to send out annual water quality reports as well to notify you.
Mary, can you tell us what exactly is happening in low-income areas and rural communities? Why are they hit the hardest? Why is it that their infrastructures are not up to date?
Well, there's a variety of factors that likely influence that. One of the biggest ones might be that per capita costs of improving your water systems are higher in smaller rural areas in particular, because you have to extend those lines out farther, and water lines are really capital intensive, so you need to spend a lot of money for the infrastructure in place to maintain those systems. A rural community in Kentucky reached out to us earlier this year about ongoing persistent water quality problems there, similar to what her findings found. This is a rural community in Texas. It's actually where Lyndon B. Johnson launched his campaign on against poverty, his war on poverty. Mm-hmm. And still today, for decades, they've had unreliable access to safe water, persistent water quality violations, particularly around disinfectant byproducts, and also just water service that's not on all the time because of massive water line breaks and leaks. This is a community where they're losing more water than they're delivering, which is kind of shocking that you would have leaks that would lose more than half of your water. But it's because of the geography of the place, going up through rural mountainous areas, and then the lack of investment in these rural communities. Rural America, just like a lot of cities, like Flint, like Detroit, like Baltimore, they're losing people. So the lack of population loss is driving it as well. Rural America is experiencing population declines. So again, that's fewer people on the system to invest in that system, because most funding for our water system comes from ratepayers. It's not tax dollars. It's not the federal government supporting it. It's people who live in that community are funding most of the improvements. And if you have high rates of poverty, declining populations, you're left with infrastructure legacies that just you can't afford to pay for anymore.
Amara, CNN recently focused on residents in Martin County, Kentucky, and they were saying that rainwater is better to drink than their water. Their water almost looks like it's the color of a lemonade. What did your research tell you about why this is affecting poor communities and rural communities the hardest?
Sure. Well, rural communities really struggle by virtue of being small, as Mary so well explained it. Small communities have smaller ratepayer bases, and so if you're not able to raise adequate funds, this means you're then left with less technical capacity in terms of being able to afford the latest and greatest treatment technologies. A lot of these communities can't even afford full-time operators, so they have to make do with part-time folks that are managing their water system, and they also don't have adequate financial resources for then going about improving their system. And they also have less ability to access advantageous conditions for loans as well. So it's a real struggle to be able to revamp their systems. And so this struggle is really being borne out across the country, but in particular, states of Oklahoma and large parts of Texas are especially struggling because they have such a high prevalence of small rural communities.
Mara Allaire is Assistant Professor of Urban Policy and Public Planning at UC Irvine. She is the lead author of the in-depth report, National Trends in Drinking Water Quality Violations, which was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And you can find that study, along with a map, at yourcallradio.org. Mary Grant is the Public Water for All Campaign Director at Food and Water Watch, a national nonprofit that champions healthy food and clean water for all. And on today's Your Calls One Planet series, we are talking about the current state of our drinking water. We have done so many shows about water quality over the years, and as our guests say, we really need to start investing in old infrastructure. That is one of the main problems about why we're facing this crisis about drinking water. We'll also talk more after the break about the privatization of water. Let's hear from David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Rose. I was interested in Flint and some of the origins issue, but as a side issue, you were just talking about agricultural drift and the poor counties. It's interesting. I was listening to a Kansas station once, and they were talking about the corporate animal, the 20,000 pigs in a warehouse in Kansas. And this woman called in and said that she can smell that place 75 miles away. You know, that might be three counties away. Mm-hmm. And when you think of that company is probably paying the agricultural tax base, which is as low as you can get, and yet they're a major polluter 75 miles away. So I would think that it might be a smart idea to have a reevaluation of the tax laws of agricultural land for these mega corporate animal husbandry arrangements. But the back to Flint, if I understand right, part of Flint's problem is the Flint River is it was polluted up to 100 years ago by the automakers. And were they given waivers at some point for their pollution? Is there a reason why they're not bearing the cost of the cleanup?
Well, thank you for the question, David. Mara, do you know?
So I would caution that I guess there's two points I would like to make. One, Flint actually tragically happened because of the pH of the water. So it wasn't the fact that the Flint River was contaminated and that, you know, contaminants were entering the water treatment plant, but it was the pH of the water was elevated, and this corroded the pipes. And the lead, in fact, came from the distribution pipes as well as in-home plumbing as well in people's homes. So it was really the fact that the water treatment plant was not getting the pH of the water correct, and this sort of led to the Flint water crisis. But I think what our listener brings up is the excellent point that there are perhaps other water quality concerns that could come from agricultural operations. And right now, actually, a major exemption, it's been this way since for the history of the Clean Water Act as well as the Safe Drinking Water Act, a major exemption to the Clean Water Act is agriculture. Agricultural runoff is not currently regulated at the national level under the Clean Water Act.
Can you talk more about that, Mary? I think this just deserves so much more attention. One Green Planet reports that in the United States alone, 32 slaughterhouses are responsible for dumping 55 million pounds of pollutants into the waterways. How does that affect our water?
Actually, really interesting. My organization just filed a lawsuit in Delaware against a processing plant in Millsboro, Delaware, because of causing high nitrate and coliform bacteria levels in the drinking water supply of its neighbors. So this agricultural operations contaminating groundwater supplies that household wells rely on. And it's a huge issue in a lot of rural America. And it's not regulated under the Clean Water Act.
Why is this not regulated?
I think part of the issue is that they regulate point sources more than non-point sources. So you can't, like, pinpoint exactly where the cause is, even though if it's along the river, it can run off into waterways. So it's not one pipe issue. Like, if you have a wastewater treatment plant, you can have a pipe going out into the river. You can see where it's coming from, the pollutant. So if it's just like it's runoff over the land, it's less regulated.
Well,
even though stormwater is regulated in cities.
Well, thank you for that call. We should definitely do a show about this. On today's Your Calls One Planet, we are talking about our drinking water, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a guest idea or a show idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. Today it is our One Planet series, and we are talking about the state of our drinking water. In the United States, the Flint, Michigan drinking water crisis raised so many questions about the quality of our tap water. And Mara Allaire, assistant professor of urban policy and public planning at UC Irvine, recently conducted a major study. It found that between 1982 and 2015, up to 45 million people every year were affected by water quality issues, especially those living in low-income and rural communities. We're also joined by Mary Grant, Public Water for All campaign director at Food and Water Watch, a national nonprofit that champions healthy food and clean water for all. And let's go next to Ron. Hi, Ron. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. I've been listening, and there have been some very interesting factors brought forward here. But I'm in Marin County in northern Marin, the Hamilton Field, Novato area, and I've been working with students that were looking at works of Dr. Don Huber in regards to glyphosate. And we've had some water issues up here where the shrubs around the water reserves, the projects that were looked at were under the KnowWhatsInIt.org campaign, that's a student service projects. And they looked at the local water, and they looked at Dr. Hubert's statements about glyphosate. And Marin at one point had a heavy use of glyphosate, which is commercially known under another banner by Monsanto, around the waterways, which when you had rain would have the runoff of these toxins into the water system, which eventually in maybe small particulate amounts would wind up in our bodies. But there's something called bioaccumulation. That's an issue I'd like to see what they're talking about with bioaccumulation that builds up in the body over decades of cancer-causing toxins. Mm-hmm. And why do we have such increases in cancers since the early 1900s that today that's one of the mainstream focuses on, either disease related to toxins position or cancers developed from toxins over years as a bioaccumulation body burden in human beings?
Well, thank you so much. So glyphosate is a widely used pesticide. The World Health Organization said that it is a carcinogen. And then the EPA under Scott Pruitt came out recently and said it is not, which he got slammed by environmental groups over that. Mara, is this something that you have studied?
I haven't specifically studied this contaminant, so I might pass this on to Mary to see if she has any specific comments.
Mary, have you studied this?
My organization had studied, it's called commonly referred to as Roundup. I haven't looked at it myself, but we know that there is aggressive lobbying by Monsanto and the rest of the agro-business giants who have asked for that, who have lobbied on EPA's assessment of it. Yeah.
Well, you know, Ron, we actually did a show recently with a journalist who has covered Monsanto for decades, and we specifically talked about Roundup. So if you go to yourcallradio.org and just search Roundup, you will find that show. Thank you so much for calling. Mara, I know we have to let you go. What would you say, with this administration in the White House, what is the best thing people can do to ensure that we have safe drinking water, especially those who live in low-income communities and rural communities?
Sure. I would say there's probably two key actions to hone in on. One is ensuring that our state-level agencies are properly funded to do the very important work they're tasked to do with keeping our drinking water safe. And this, I would say, is a trend that has been ongoing for the past 30 years, that there's been incredible cuts to state-level agencies for doing enforcement of the very drinking water standards we've been devoting so much time this morning to discussing. So I would say ensuring that those agencies are properly funded is certainly the first step. Another action, besides devoting greater resources to water infrastructure across the country, is perhaps to take a close look at where it might make sense to either consolidate small systems or to have small systems take advantage of purchased water contracts where they can actually get their water from larger systems that do have the capacity to adequately treat drinking water. And so this is something that also came out of my latest study, where systems that did rely on purchasing their water from larger systems actually had less of a chance of violating national standards.
Well, Mara, thank you for your research and thank you for joining us. We'd love to check in with you in the coming months to find out if you have found any new information and just to give us an update.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. Mara Allaire is Assistant Professor of Urban Policy and Public Planning at UC Irvine. You can find out more about the research she conducted. She found that between 1982 and 2015, every year up to 45 million people were affected by water quality issues, especially those living in low-income and rural communities. And sticking with us for the rest of the show is Mary Grant, Public Water for All Campaign Director at Food and Water Watch. Mary, you have written several pieces about the infrastructure in this country. And the American Society of Civil Engineers gives the country's drinking water facilities a D grade, D as in dog, and says $1 trillion will be needed to fix the infrastructure over the next 25 years. How would the water infrastructure be affected by the White House infrastructure plan, the $1.5 trillion infrastructure plan?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So the Trump administration has proposed a $200 billion plan. I know he says that he'll inject $200 billion in order to leverage to investments up to $1.5 trillion. But what his actual proposal is just $200 billion. And it's funded by cutting existing infrastructure. One of the things his budget proposed to eliminate this year is grants for rural water systems. So it's actually, some analyses have found that it's a net loss of infrastructure funding if you look at his budget. So it's interesting, but even the principles outlined in that infrastructure plan, it wouldn't benefit our water systems. There's no money dedicated to water infrastructure. He has this idea of creating an incentives program. So a new program that would incentivize localities and states to invest in infrastructure, awarding grants to places that can afford to pay for new infrastructure. So 20% would be federal dollars. The rest would have to come from new sources of funding. So that's new taxes, new tolls, rate hikes, and privatization of our infrastructure. So I think one of the biggest worries I have about this method of allocating funding is that it's going to shift federal resources from low-income communities to wealthier cities, likely whiter cities, that can afford to raise their own revenue, because it's rewarding cities that can raise their own revenue instead of dedicating funding, prioritizing funding to communities with real needs, like water quality violations, high rates of poverty, water affordability issues. You see a confluence of that in Flint, high rates of poverty, water quality violations, and real affordability challenges with their water system. So funding won't be going to Flint under his plan. It'll be going to wealthier areas. I think that's my biggest concern about his plan, as well as handing the keys of our water system over to Wall Street, which we found also just exacerbates existing water affordability challenges.
And we'll talk about that in a minute. But in terms of the infrastructure plan, what's the likelihood of this actually going through?
It seems like every week is infrastructure week with the Trump administration. Whenever there is an ongoing scandal, he'll just start talking about infrastructure again. I know he's touring around the country right now talking about infrastructure, but even his administration has admitted that it's unlikely to pass this year, and if it does pass, it'll be piecemeal. So he'll address water separately, then transportation, various different pieces of legislation he might try to advocate for. But I know that the Senate Democrats have rejected his plan and put out their own proposal that stands in sharp contrast to that, which hopefully it's important to make sure that they don't compromise on a bad infrastructure deal. Our infrastructure needs are so great, and there's a real potential for bipartisan support for infrastructure. We just have to get it right, and I hope that they don't, and I think we all need to call on them not to compromise on a bad deal.
The EPA sets standards for drinking water quality, and Scott Pruitt, the head of the EPA, has been working relentlessly to weaken environmental regulations, including those that affect our water resources. How has this White House affected the safety of our drinking water so far?
Yeah, they have a rule that getting rid of new regulations in exchange for every new regulation they put up. It's a really massive deregulation agenda, regulating our water, as well as the laws that protect our water supplies. They got rid of the Waters of the U.S. Act. It's facing legal challenge now, but stopping that rulemaking to protect water sources that supply the drinking water supply for 1 in 3 people across the country. So that's one direct way he's already impacted our water supplies. His infrastructure plan does half of it set out deregulation, a one-stop shop. He had an executive order last August that he issued about a one-stop shop for federal regulation, so trying to streamline federal regulations and then also cut the public out of the process and to facilitate it and expedite it without having, by just removing some of the protections that we have for public input and environmental protections. One of his major proposals in his infrastructure plan that's particularly concerning is that he wants to have unilateral control over allowing oil and gas pipelines through a national park, so giving the Secretary of the Interior unilateral control over that decision, or stripping away congressional approval of those pipeline projects through our national treasures, our public lands.
Mary Grant is Public Water for All campaign director at Food and Water Watch. On today's One Planet series, we are talking about the current state of our drinking water. Let's hear from Phil in San Francisco. Hi, Phil. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose. I guess a few quick things. One, America is known as one of the great assets of this country is its potable water, which has been an effort since our inception. And then, two, I noticed that when we were counting the different governments, especially for rural communities, the county government becomes very key in terms of its ability and capacity to help with the situation. And then thirdly, I know that, you know, from my age, way back when, there were such things as water bond issues. And then, too, just on this show alone, we realized that the bond debt of Flint, Michigan, became one of the key parts of the financial crush. And then on a personal note of last is 1990, I went to Hong Kong, and they did not have, at that time, drinkable waters. And so since then, they now do. And so, come on, America, let's get busy.
Okay. I mean, yeah, thank you, Phil. I mean, we've been talking to your colleagues at Food and Water Watch, Mary, for at least a decade about this issue. I mean, talking about the need to improve our infrastructure, which would create millions of jobs and would provide people with clean water in the wealthiest country on earth. I mean, what do you think it'll take to actually get there? I mean, is that at the top of your list at this point, is to improve the infrastructure?
I think that's what we need to do. We need to improve our drinking water infrastructure, and I think it's going to get there with people power, people coming together, building a movement, and then building that political will to get it done. There is bipartisan support for funding our infrastructure. There's debates about how you fund it, and I think that, as we saw with the massive tax cuts from the Trump administration, that there's that the idea that there's not funding available isn't valid anymore. And that we just need to build a movement of people together to hold our elected officials accountable and make sure that we can fully fund our water systems. There's actually really good legislation coming out later this month from Representatives Keith Ellison and Ro Khanna, the Water Act, the Water Affordability, Transparency, Equity, and Reliability Act, which would fully fund our water systems, not just the infrastructure assets, but also septic systems in rural America, drinking water wells in rural America, to make sure that every person, regardless of their income, has access to safe and affordable water.
As you said, and Food and Water Watch has done so many studies about this, the privatization of water, it continues to happen, and now we have studies about the end result when that does happen. Give us an update on the privatization of water across the country.
We're seeing large companies, French multinationals, partner with private equity firms to target struggling cities for a long-term lease of water assets. We're seeing smaller systems being approached by companies like American Water and Aqua America to sell off their systems to the company. But overall, the trend is actually toward public ownership, at least from 2007 to 2014. The portion of people with water service from a publicly owned system increased from 83% to 87%. So So publicly owned water, locally controlled water, is the American way.
Hmm.
We're seeing publicly owned systems, we're seeing cities not only purchase water systems from local governments or from privately owned systems, but we're also seeing large cities purchase small private systems outside. So a big example of that is Missoula, Montana. It was the last city in Montana with a privately controlled water system. It was controlled by a private equity firm, the Carlyle Group, which mid public purchase actually sold it to a Canadian company. And so Missoula sued through the court system, won a state Supreme Court case that found that public control of water is more necessary for the public well-being than private control is.
And this was a four-year court battle, and the public purchased this water system from Carlyle for $84 million. There's a good piece about this in High Country News by Karen Knutson, Beware the Privatization of Your Town's Water. And she writes, for the first time in our town's history, ownership of our water system, pipes, pumps, wells, wilderness lakes, and dams, has landed where it belongs in the hands of the people, where it can be managed for the public good for all time. So can you talk about how this process works? How was the Carlyle Group able to buy the water system in the first place?
So since the beginning, the water system had been privately owned, but it formed as a small privately owned, like mom-and-pop operation. A small company owned it. And then the Carlyle Group, right after the financial crisis happened, the recession, they were looking at safe bets to put their money. So they started this infrastructure fund that started purchasing up assets that were low risk. And water is a very low risk asset for investors because everyone needs water. They pay their bills because you need to have it. So they use this infrastructure fund to buy the water system from the small private owner. And then, as private equity firms do, they then flipped it off 5 years later, which is a main driver for why the city wanted to purchase its water system. It wanted local, stable, sustainable control over its water system, especially as our climate is changing. They were worried about water scarcity issues in the future and water supplies issues in the future because of climate change. And so they wanted that local control in order to protect their water supply, not just for now, but for future generations.
What does it take for the public to take their water back from a private equity firm?
It's a major battle. Unfortunately, the company refused to negotiate with the city in Missoula, even though it had promised that it would, that before it sold it off to the Canadian company, it was supposed to go to the city with an offer. That was what the Carlyle Group executive told the mayor of Missoula, is that he would come to him first before he sold it off. But he didn't do that, so it actually was a major legal battle. They had to first prove that public ownership was necessary, and then they had to fight over how much the company gets paid. So it was a two-step process through the court system, but the city resoundingly won because public ownership was found to be more necessary than private ownership.
Food and Water Watch has done many surveys about what happens when water is placed in public hands, and you find that utility costs go up, in some cases, 59%. In Bayonne, New Jersey, the price of water skyrocketed by about 28% after the private equity giant Kohlberg Kravis Roberts took charge of the city system. And again, this is according to that High Country News piece. What else happens, Mary, when a private equity firm takes over the water system?
So the biggest thing we see with privatization is that loss of local control. So that's local control over decisions about how much you pay, what your rates are, who pays what, how you design your rates, so how much local businesses are paying versus households. Another big issue is about where investments are made and who benefits from these investments. Usually the biggest issue we see, especially when you involve private equity firms and private financing, is the cost of water. So on average, as you said, for-profit private utilities charge households 59% more than local governments. So that's hundreds of dollars a year more that people are paying just because their system is privately controlled. And in some states, it can be even more severe. In Bayonne, what happened? So Bayonne was promised a rate freeze, and a four-year rate freeze. And what actually happened during those 4 years was that increase of 28%. So the city negotiated a deal, sold off, leased off its water and sewer systems to this private equity firm and a French multinational, And they were promised that rate freeze that never materialized. And also in the first year of the deal, liens against homes over unpaid water bills, which can lead to foreclosure, tripled in the first year of the deal. Mm-hmm. There was a great New York Times expose that looked at the deal in Bayonne, as well as other private equity deals.
In a piece for Food and Water Watch, you write that more than 1 in 10 people nationally are struggling to pay their water bills. Low-income towns and communities of color pay higher water rates than their wealthier, whiter neighbors. And even within a community, the harm is not felt equally. You write about water shutoffs in places like Boston and Detroit, and then corporate investors or private equity firms, which are completely driven by profits, have no reason to put money into low-income and rural areas.
Yeah, we've seen that private companies can leapfrog around small, struggling rural systems. In West Virginia, American Water has been documented to do that, leap around these small, struggling rural areas. And the water affordability crisis is growing across the country. And part of it's because of that lack of federal investment, that our water systems are aging across the country. Many of our water systems were built using that federal support, and that's no longer there. So water and sewer systems are now aging, and they need increased investment. So there's a lot of consequences to unaffordable water bills. One is water shutoffs. We've most notably in Detroit, where tens of thousands of people still every year experience water shutoffs because they can't afford to pay their water bill. I think they just announced 18,000 households. So that's tens of thousands of people.
Wow.
Are facing water shutoff in Detroit right now. Flint, again, is also facing water shutoff now because people didn't want to pay water bills for water that they can't afford, can't drink.
And if your water is privatized, if a private equity firm out of the state owns your water supply, you're basically writing a check and you're sending it out of state. So if you have an issue, who do you go to? I mean, how is the water regulated? Who are these companies accountable to?
So it really depends on how the contract is set up. With these lease concession deals, it's actually much less regulated than with an asset sale. If it's privately owned, you have state regulators like the Public Service Commission or the Public Utility Commission that actually regulate the rates. There's some issues with how responsive they are to public concerns. They're bound by the state statutes and what they can actually look at. One of the things they don't look at is whether or not the rates are affordable for households. But they do look at the reasonableness of the rates and do manage to keep rates down. But with these lease concession deals, there's no state oversight. There's very little local oversight. It's all set by this legal contract, hundreds of pages of legalese that city governments, especially cash-strapped city governments, aren't in a position to negotiate over.
Wow.
So they have these fire sales of assets. They're trapped into decades-long terms that they have very little oversight of.
Mary, we have about a 2 minutes left. Looking ahead, what should we be most concerned about when it comes to our water quality, and what can we do about it?
I think it really depends on where you are. If you're in San Francisco or New York City, you have excellent water quality. If you live in an older home and you're worried about lead, you can get a filter that's certified to remove lead in your water. I think nationally, though, we need to all come together and call on our Congress members to support federal funding for our water system so we can maintain and improve our water service and make sure that people who aren't in New York City or San Francisco have access to safe water.
And have you been following what's happening in San Francisco? We just got an email from a listener who says, for years, all of our water came from Hetch Hetchy. In the last year, San Francisco is now adding groundwater. Do you think that our water could be affected by this?
Oh, that's interesting. I haven't been following that. When you do change your source of water, it can affect your water quality, but San Francisco has excellent water quality. They have excellent treatment systems and processes. But I do encourage you to reach out to your local utility if you have concerns about the switch of water supply.
Right, because you can actually ask your utility to let you know what's in your water. And they have to either point you to a website or send you a list, right? Is that how it works?
Yeah, every year. And if they have a violation, they're supposed to notify you as well. But yeah, usually for San Francisco, you can find your water quality report on the website. You can also just call your local utility. There are folks who live in your community because it's publicly owned, and they can answer your questions.
Well, Mary, thank you so much for all the work you do on this issue, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Mary Grant is the Public Water for All campaign director at Food and Water Watch, a national nonprofit that champions healthy food and clean water for all. And she has done extensive work on the privatization of water, what happens when private equity firms take over water and the bills go up, and more than 1 in 10 people in this country struggle to pay their water bills. And as she said, I mean, imagine what it's like if your water is just cut off. People can lose their homes through foreclosures because of unpaid water bills. So this is such an important issue. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. If you'd like to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Josh Wilner is our social media producer. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.